Hi, this is Dave Olson. I'm the senior leader of Heartland Church located in Ankeny, Iowa. I hope the following message challenges, encourages, and ultimately changes you. Thanks for joining us.
I was speaking up near Knoxville a little over a year ago, and a woman came up to me and she said, have you heard of Honor Air? And I said, yeah, I've heard of it. You know, and they were taking World War II veterans and Korean veterans. Well, she said, well, now we're taking Vietnam veterans, which means you guys are getting old. You know, that greatest generation has passed away. I mean, last November, I spoke to a luncheon in Atlanta, 400 veterans, one World War II veteran, one. And then the Korean, and I guess us guys now. In fact, I was amazed at how many grateful when we went. I went to Washington, D.C. in April with 131 veterans, three Korean War veterans, and 127 Vietnam veterans, and one Desert Storm veteran. And we went to all these memorials. Now, 30 years ago, right before we left here, I had done a Victory Over Vietnam conference, facilitate a Victory Over Vietnam conference at the 700 Club. We did seven, I think, in 5 years. And the year before we moved to Chattanooga, we went to the wall in Washington, D.C., the Vietnam Memorial. And when we went there, they have all the statistics. If you know a name and where they were born, you can go there and they'll give you a piece of paper and your pencil and you make an etching of that person's name that's engraved on the wall. 58,000 names of those who paid the ultimate price in Vietnam. And my best friend Danny, I'll talk about in just a minute, was killed standing right next to me in our first major battle. We had gone through all our training together. He was my best friend. And the first combat operator was killed right next to me. And so I knew Danny died in February of 1966. I went to the panel and I went to the book of the names. And there were four Daniels. I couldn't remember where, you know, I had a horrible time remembering names. And I still struggle at times because I blotted it all out. I didn't want to remember. I wanted to forget. But there were four Daniels in the Marine Corps that died in Vietnam in February of 1960. I couldn't remember his name. And people were going and they were putting the etchings and I couldn't remember his name. And this time when I went, it wasn't so emotional because as I was getting ready to go to Vietnam, I did not know at that time that God took all that pain, all that healing away. And so this time I was able just to minister to the other people that are there. But, you know, I went to the World War II Memorial and the Korean Memorial. Neither one of those were in Washington, D.C. They had the Vietnam Memorial before they had the World War II and Korean Memorial. Went to the wall and, it was powerful to think of the price of freedom. But, you know, the ultimate price for our freedom, the veterans, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude to them. But the one that paid the ultimate price for our freedom is the person of Jesus Christ. And, you know, and I love, you know, what John said, when the Son has made you free, you are free indeed. Amen. When I joined the Marine Corps, you know, I shared this in the first service, you know, and every now and then I'll mention some program, you know, TV program surely you'll go, they weren't even alive, Raj, when that program, you know, come out. And I mentioned, you know, that when I volunteered to go to Vietnam, and I had said, because I knew what combat was all about, you know, and I said, it's kind of like when you get married. And there were people that did that same thing. They just left. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when you get married, you think you know what you're doing, but then I'm going to let Pastor Dave work that out with you. But, you know, I had seen on TV, I had seen John Wayne and the Sands of Iwo Jima three times. And, yeah, I see a couple of my mature brothers here today that you might remember Tuesday night, Vic Morrow on combat. You know, so man, I had to, and you know, so I thought I've got this all figured out. You know, so when we shipped out to Vietnam in the fall of 1965, man, I knew the war was going to be over quickly because the Marines had landed, and like I said, so Vietnam was a different kind of war. It was guerrilla warfare. Guerrilla warfare is where your enemy lets you wait till it's his advantage to let you find him. And so our first major operation, we were on a search and destroy mission south of the demilitarized zone. And we had 217 Marines in a reinforced infantry company. And we got woken up in the middle of the night, flown, and we landed in an open field, set up a perimeter real quick. And from 2 till dawn, we sat there not knowing what was going on. They got the squad leaders together, said, okay, a village at a South Vietnamese army post nearby had been overrun in the night by an unknown size enemy force. And so they put us on helicopters. We landed. We started out at dawn. And for hours and hours, we kept searching for this elusive enemy. We would see signs that they'd been there, discarded equipment, some bloody bandages. And, all day, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm exhausted. I'm barely 18. I'm carrying about 50 pounds of explosives and ammunition for the mortar crew. And we're walking across. I've never been so tired in my life. And I remember looking at my platoon sergeant, who was a Korean War veteran who took us new guys under his wing. And I remember asking him, "Sergeant, are we going to take a break?" And as I was talking to him, we did not know that we had pushed a battalion of Viet Cong regulars, 650 enemy soldiers, into a tree line on a peninsula. We had pushed them. They had nowhere else to go. And we were walking across this open field. And I remember as I was asking my platoon sergeant if we were going to take a break, the enemy opened fire. And as I was looking at my platoon sergeant, I saw his head literally explode as a 51 caliber machine gun round hit him in the head, killing him instantly. And I remember as I started to throw myself down out of the corner of my eye, I saw as my best friend Danny took a machine gun round to the chest, killing him instantly, and throw him backwards. And I remember throwing myself down to the ground and looking, I couldn't see anything but muzzle flashes in the tree line. And I remember shooting at an enemy that I couldn't even see. And so we lay there in the open field, and I could hear our company commander on the radio screaming over the sounds of explosions. They were dropping mortars and rockets, and we were pinned down this field, and I could hear him calling for artillery, calling for gunships, calling for anything that would suppress the enemy's fire. And after about 15 minutes, the command went up and down the line to assault the tree line because we couldn't lay there exposed. Now I'm going to be real honest with you, I remember there was a movie, nobody remembers, but some of us old people, years ago, Audie Murphy played a Civil War movie called The Red Badge of Courage. And I think it was the first battle that they had, some of them dropped their weapons and ran. And I'll be honest with you, I had never seen anybody die before. And I'm laying there on the field, I'm firing the jungle, and I'm trying to get as low to the ground as I can, really praying for the ground to open up and swallow me. I did not want to get up because I knew I would never make it to that tree line. But then to my left, I saw my fellow Marines get up. On my right, I saw my fellow Marines get up and run to the battle. And I didn't want to be, because you depend on the person on your left and on your right. And so I got up, and I knew I wasn't going to make it, but somehow I did. I got to the tree line. It was over in 45 minutes, and at 45 minutes, my company of 219 Marines was reduced to 78 men that had not been killed or wounded. And they took my unit out of the field, and then they asked for volunteers. I remember I had two uncles that were Korean War veterans. They were Army. Nothing personal, they were telling my brother and I, my twin brother I joined together, says, "Do never volunteer. You never volunteer. You don't tell. You volunteer to go in." So they were volunteers. So they're asking for volunteers to move from the bases out into the villages and live with the people, train the local militia to take, their communities back from the Viet Cong. So I went out, we moved into the village, and it's just, I love the people of Vietnam. But they, and I felt sorry for them. You know, because they faced oppression. If they were, you know, ever the enemy ever came in their village and they supported the Americans, they would kill them. You know, they would come to villages at night, take their sons or daughters into the jungle and make, you know, and make them become communist soldiers and serve the communists. And so, you know, we lived in the villages. We ate with them. We fought with them, we bled with them, and sometimes we died with them, winning the hearts and the minds. And for the time that we were doing it, worked. That they loved us, we loved them, we built. And so we began to know the territory around our villages. We patrolled day, night, afternoon, and we learned the area as well as the people that lived there, so that the enemy, at that time, before we started doing this, the enemy controlled the night. And, you know, the South Vietnamese army would withdraw to their bases and the communists could do whatever they want. When we moved in, now they had to wonder when, you know, they were going to run into us. And so I became a point man. You know, the point man was the guy, you lead the patrol out. Your job is to, you know, avoid the booby traps, avoid the ambushes, find the enemy, kill them, and then get back to your village. And I knew the whole area around my village. And I had, at that time, I had good hearing, you know. I asked Shirley, what was that person's name again? And she goes, that's not what I heard, but anyways, a lot more fun of that. But I had good hearing. I still got good peripheral vision, you know. So I'm the point guy. Well, one day, my squad leader went on R&R, you know, for a week out of the country, and they sent us a new squad leader from our rear area, and I didn't know why. So we're preparing for this patrol that night, and I was telling them, look, there's been a lot of enemy activity. We're going to try to go out there and, you know, and disrupt the plans they have to attack our village. And so he and I got into a discussion. I'm calling it a discussion, as an argument about how to, you know, what we were going to do. And so he got mad at me. He was a sergeant. I was a lance corporal. So he put me at the back. You know, there was 13 of us, and I was number 11 in the line as we went out on patrol. And so this sergeant, I don't know what he was trying to prove, but he's on a patrol. We're going down a trail he had never been on, only seen it on an overlay and a map. And as we were coming to the fishing village where we were going to set up our ambush, he was walking point. And I was, you know, we were stretched out on the rice paddy dike. And I remember as we came into the village, all of a sudden, the hair literally stood up on the back of my neck. And on my arms, it's like something was wrong. And before I could even yell or say anything, the enemy opened fire. We had walked into what was called an L-shaped ambush, and the gunfire was just horrendous. And behind me, a mine went off and blew me and the two guys behind me off the trail into the rice paddy. And I remember laying floating on my back in the rice paddy, just, you know, the concussion. I was dazed. I was trying to figure out what's going on. And I'm laying there, and literally, it was like ghosts come out of the jungle. And anybody, they went up and down the line on the rice paddy, on the trail. And anybody that was still alive, they killed them, took all their weapons, equipment, and probably less than 2 minutes, just disappeared like ghost again back into the jungle. And I'm laying there floating, trying to get my senses. And after I finally, where I could start to hear and get what was going on, I could hear some moaning. And the two guys behind me had taken the whole impact of the explosion and were seriously wounded. And I got them up on the rice, against the rice paddy dike, and they're moaning, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, keep them quiet, because I expected the enemy any minute that they'd hear us and come back. And I remember crawling up the trail to see if anybody was alive, and I got to our radio man. Our radio man was a big guy. He was a Samoan, you know, think of The Rock, you know, big guy. And he was so big that when he fell backwards, when he was shot, the radio was underneath him, you know, and it didn't even, we had the radio. I called. We always had a platoon on standby. Within a half an hour, they flew, landed on the rice paddy dike, the spread out. They took the two wounded guys, put them in a medevac flight, and then we took, you know, everybody in front of me had been killed. You know, that sergeant was shot 27 different times. And, you know, and so they put me and my 10 fellow Marines and corpsmen in that helicopter and flew us back to the rear. The next morning, they told me, when I went to the company headquarters, they said that my friends had died on the helicopter, never made it to the hospital. And, you know, and one 18-year-old Marine survived that ambush, and he would carry the guilt of surviving for 23 years. I did two tours back to back. You know, I was wounded twice, and both times I wanted to get out of the hospital, get back to my Marines as fast as I could. And then finally, you know, one day we were on a fire base and we got hit in the middle of the night, and we all through the night we fought the enemy off. At dawn, you know, the enemy withdrew, and some helicopters landed. Our division commander actually wanted to, you know, get an update, and they flew in. And so I'm standing there, just standing around. Somebody said, "Helly." Nobody pronounces our last name right, you know. I've been called Brother Hell so many times. But so, "Helly," and I hear, and he said, "Get on that chopper." And I, you know, okay, you know, got on a chopper, and they flew me back to Da Nang. They said, "Get your gear." Put me on a plane to Okinawa to the States. Met my brother in Okinawa. We both were coming back on the same day. Got into L.A. A police officer said, "You guys are lucky. You just missed the protesters that were throwing pig's blood on everybody in the uniform that was coming back." And we got home. Now this little humor here. We got in a taxi cab and went to my parents' house. Knocked on the door, you know, like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And the door opens, and here's, you remember that movie, you know, Throw Mama from the Train? You know, that here's that woman, cigarette hanging from her mouth, little thing on her head, and, you know, bunny slippers with a big robe. And Ron and I are looking at each other. We look up at the address. "That's the address." Look at her. And I go, "Hi, is my mom here?" And I thought, you know, maybe she had somebody staying. I don't, you know. And she said, "Do I look like your mother?" Slammed the door right in our face. My parents had moved. You know, that would have been nice to know. But so now it's 1967. And, you know, things had happened. Because in Vietnam, you know, the media so grossly distorted what was happening in Vietnam that, you know, my mom said, "Rod, look, I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad you're home. But this Vietnam thing, it's a little, you know, awkward, wasn't, you know," but it was like, but it's embarrassing, you know. "So let's do this. Let's not talk about it. Let's just pretend like it didn't happen, and let's get on with our life." Well, I want to tell you, friends, I wanted to get on my life. I was so grateful to be alive. And I wanted to forget, but there was only one problem, and that was when I would go to bed at night and I would close my eyes, I would remember all over again. But I was very fortunate because I was still in the Marine Corps and I was surrounded by guys just like me that I could look at their ribbons on their uniforms and know where they'd been, what they've done. And there was that camaraderie, you know, that esprit de corps, that fellowship. And so I was 3 years in the United States. I was a drill instructor for a year and a half. That was interesting. I didn't want to be a drill instructor, and you know, I believe in like having fun, and so, but it worked for me because the recruits would say, "Stay away from that guy. He is crazy. Is it just guy?" And I did that for a year and a half, and then I reenlisted to be a criminal investigator. You know, Leroy Jethro Gibbs. I had a better haircut, and you know, I did that for about 20 months, and so in 1970, I volunteered to go back to Vietnam. And, you know, after I become a Christian, people I knew, they'd say, "Dude, what was wrong? What were you thinking when, you know, you volunteered to go back for a third tour?" And, you know, for a long time, I would just kind of nervously laugh it off. And I'd say, "Well, you know, I'm a Marine and, you know, we're just not that smart." And, you know, now, just so you know, we're the only ones who can say that about ourselves. Okay. And I would just laugh it off. But really, and I realized, one, is that by 1970, because of the media, because of the anti-war movement, this country had changed so dramatically that, I mean, I would put my uniform on and go somewhere, and some peace protester wanted to kill me for peace. That was always interesting. Or somebody called me a baby killer. And when I was in Vietnam, there was not, that's not who was killing the babies. And, you know, I felt like this isn't my home anymore. I don't recognize my own country. And I felt more needed, useful, accepted, 12,000 miles from home, stinking, leech-infested, rice paddy, mosquito, malaria-infested. I felt more needed, accepted there than I did in my own country. And so I went back to Vietnam. I went back to the village. They had reorganized what they were doing and called it a combined action group. And I was back in the village. I had actually three squads of Marines, a platoon of Vietnamese militia. And we had four or five villages south of Da Nang, the big military base at Da Nang that I was responsible for. And we did the same thing. We started because they hadn't been doing it. My predecessor had not. They stayed in the villages and the enemy was everywhere. And so we began taking the night away from the enemy again. And one day we planned an operation. We hit a guerrilla base camp completely by surprise, surround them in the middle of the night, hit them at dawn, killed a bunch of Viet Cong, captured a bunch of equipment. There was so much stuff there that we couldn't even carry it away. So a couple of days later, I thought it would be a good idea. Let's load up with explosives to go out there and blow up these bunkers so that they can't, and the equipment, so they can't be used again. So as we started off, I was walking point. Now, I shouldn't have been walking point, and I didn't consciously know why I was walking point, but in reality, you know, several years earlier, that my mind would always say, if I had been walking point that night, would I have known, you know, would we have walked into an ambush? And so as I'm walking across the field, it takes longer to tell the story than the time that it took, but I stopped at the edge of a field looking for tripwires, and something flew through the air, hit me in the thigh, and fell right in front of me. And I looked down, and laying at my feet was a grenade. And before I could move, before I could think, as it registered, it went off, just ripping me apart and throwing me back several feet. And when I hit the ground, it was the most incredible fear and surge of adrenaline that I had ever experienced. I knew I was hurt, and I knew that I needed to get away from where I was. And I managed to struggle to my feet. I had blood all over my face, and I reached up and wiped the blood out of my eyes, and about 40 feet from me, like where that camera is, there was a North Vietnamese soldier and had his rifle pointed at me, and I saw the barrel recoil and felt the bullets as they hit me and knocked me back to the ground. I mean, I hit the ground face first. I had my face buried in the ground, and I was struggling to roll over because I was carrying about 40-some pounds of explosive. And I remember rolling over and look up, and that soldier that I believe was the one that shot me was standing over me. And I remember laying on the ground looking up at this young man as he raised his rifle over his head and run his bayonet through my stomach as I was laying on the ground. I thought, this is not happening. This is a nightmare. This is just, it's not happening. And I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be okay. And the nightmare went on, and somehow I was able to get to my feet, and I took a couple of steps, and I fell. I struggled, got to my feet, took another couple of steps, and fell, moving back to my feet. Finally, I just fell, and I couldn't get up. I just rolled over and looked up in a beautiful blue sky, and there were palm trees just, you know, kind of blowing in the wind, and there was a rice, freshly planted rice paddy right next to the dike where I was laying. I watched the wind as it rippled across the freshly planted emerald rice paddy stalks, and then pain that I had never experienced before just hit me, every part of my body, and it hurt so bad. I just wanted to close my eyes, and you know, I was tired of the killing, tired of the suffering, tired, and I knew I was going to die on that trail, and I just closed my eyes, and then all of a sudden I was being dragged across the field, and there was like a moment of terror because I thought, if it's the communists that have me, I'm in really deep trouble. And then I heard a voice in my ear. As my 21-year-old Navy corpsman said, I've got you. I've got you. And I remember them trying to stop the bleeding. I remember them calling for a medevac flight. There were none available. A Marine helicopter, supply helicopter, big double rotor Sikorsky, heard the call, landed. They put me in this great big open, you know, the cargo bay of this big helicopter in the middle on a stretcher. And I remember looking over at the door gunner, and he looked over and just shook his head, looked out the window, never looked back. It was about a 15-minute flight. And as we went higher and higher, I could feel myself getting colder and colder as the blood was just literally draining out of me. And they got me to less than 15 minutes. I was in a triage at a hospital, 95th Army Evac Hospital, MASH Hospital at Da Nang at China Beach. And I remember all the activity, the smells, the sounds, the blood, you know, charred skin, blood. I wasn't the only casualty. And I remember a doctor coming up and putting a mask on my face. And he said, son, we're going to take you down to surgery. And over the next few days, I was in and out of consciousness. I remember one day when I was an investigator, my training investigator was a guy named Mike Smith. Mike was a staff sergeant. And I remember I woke up one day and Mike was leaning over what I thought was my bed. And you know, he was looking at him. He had tears. He was an African American. My trainer loved the guy. He'd have me over to his house for dinner and his family, and he was, had tears running down his eyes, and he said, you're going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And I never saw him again. Some years later, my brother was at Camp Pendleton, and I went to visit him, and he said, what was that guy, you know, that trained you, that investigator? I said, Mike Smith. He said, we got a new provost marshal on the base. He's a major, but his name's Mike Smith. He's a black Marine. And so I went to the provost marshal's office. I walked in and I said, is Major Smith in? And said, no, he's not in yet. But I said, could I wait? And he said, sure. So I sat with my back to the door. And so a little bit later, you know, he came in. The corporal jumped up. Good morning. So I said, at ease, corporal, sat down. So I got up, looked at him. I said, is this where I sign up to, can sign up to enlist? And this guy looked at me for a minute, and I mean, his face went white, you know. And he says, Helly? I said, yeah. So we hugged each other. We cried. He took me to the officers' club for lunch, which is kind of cool because I'm a retired sergeant. You know? And we're talking. I said, Mike, I said, I thought I saw you when I was in the hospital. I said, was that you or was I just dreaming? And he looked at me for a moment. He said, you know, because I had a top secret, a security clearance, you know, when they want to make sure you don't divulge something. So he was sent there and he was standing there. He said, when I got there, he said, they had operated on you, and you were still on the gurney from the operating room, and they pushed you out into the hallway and laid a body bag over the end of your gurney. And, you know, because you weren't supposed to make it. And he said, and I didn't want to see you die. I never knew how close I had come. And so in and out of consciousness, 6 days later, my brother comes in and I wake up, and now I don't know what I look like. And he walks past my bed and he stops where there's a doctor a couple beds away. And he says, excuse me, sir. He said, I'm Sergeant Haley's brother. Could you tell me where my brother's at? And the doctor looked at him, put the chart down, and I could hear him. I couldn't turn my head, but I could see him out of the corner of my eye. I said, son, he said, your brother's going to die. We've done everything we can do. He's not going to make it. And my brother stood there, and he said, well, could I see him? He said, they told me he's in this ward, but I can't find him. Apparently, he had walked past my bed a couple times. And so the doctor took him by one arm, and a nurse came over on the other side, walked him back to my bed, stopped, and just stood there. And my brother turned and looked at this mass of human rubble laying on the bed, ripped apart, 70-some shrapnel wounds, burns, 2 bullet wounds. He stands there, and his face just went white, and he started to weep. And he took a step toward my bed, and his legs buckled underneath him, and he grabbed the end of my bed just sobbing. I want to tell you, church, I had never been so afraid in my life. I felt a fear that day greater than anything on the battlefield. And I was 22 years old, 3 months from my 23rd birthday. And I lay in bed, I said, God, if there really is a God, if you let me live, I'll do anything you want. And I went to sleep, passed out. And I can remember off and on over the next few days as I would wake up. My brother was always there. He was on the floor sleeping or sitting in a chair. One night he got to sleep in a bed that was not occupied. And he told me some years later, he said, about the 10th day, the doctor took him aside. And it had been on the 6th day he got there. He had been in the field. And he said, the doctor took him aside. He said, Sergeant, your brother's going to live. He's a mess, but he's going to live. And it was a few days, about a week after that, before they felt I was strong enough to survive the flight home. So they put me on a plane, and on the way to Japan to refuel, I started bleeding internally. So they took me off the plane, took me to the naval hospital at Yokosuka Navy Base in Japan. I had 5 surgeries over a couple weeks. Then they put me on another flight back home. I got to Chicago, Great Lakes Naval Hospital outside of Chicago. When they took me in, to the triage to change my bandages. It was taking the bandages off, and this foul smell filled the triage room. And the doctor looked at me and said, son, he said, you got gangrene in your leg. We're going to have to take it off. That was a rhetorical question. You know, I couldn't talk because I was not in agreement with that. And so I'm in over the next few days, I would wake up different times in that day, and this doctor and a team, like morning, night, middle of the night, this guy was working on my leg. And one night I woke up, you know, I was a light sleeper. And, you know, one morning I woke up, was startled because somebody was standing by my bed in the middle of the night. And I looked over, here's this doctor. And when he saw that I was awake, he looked at me, smiled. And I'm almost sure this guy's a Christian. And he looked at me and he said, Sergeant, he said, that gangrene's gone. And he smiled, kind of shook his head, grinned. He said, you know, that kind of gangrene just doesn't go away. And he was Navy, I'm Marine. So, Doc, Marines are tough. No. That was about all I could say because I could hardly. So he shook his head, walked away. And so then they said one of the bullets had shattered my right arm and shattered the elbow. And so they said they found a bone infection. So I said, son, we're going to have to take the arm off above the elbow to stop the infection from spreading. And that was not they weren't asking my opinion. So I remember waking up in recovery. And as I was waking up in recovery, I realized I was holding my right hand. Navy guys, they like to play tricks on Marines, you know. So I thought they just didn't throw the parts away, you know, just parts is parts. But then my fingers moved. And so, so the doctor came in. He said, I was all prepared to amputate your arm, but something compelled me. And they cut it open, you know, from the elbow all the way up. They said, something compelled me. They said, we cut it open. The bone infection is gone. So we did this, and, you know, medical terms, I have no idea what it was, you know. And then they began to tell me, okay, you're going to be here two and a half years. You're going to have surgery, therapy, recovery, then more surgery, therapy, recovery. We're going to put pins and plates in your legs. You're going to have leg braces. You'll have 15% use of your right arm. You got shrapnel in your eyes. Cause you to go blind, you won't be able to have any children, and you know, kind of on and on. They went to encourage me. And, 9 months later, 26 operations, 4 plastic surgery operations on my face. Yeah, I didn't always look this good. And 9 months later, I walked out of the hospital and I was okay, at least on the outside. And then I went to work for a private security investigation company. I became a professional investigator, you know, wore a suit, tie, you know. And I learned 1971 after I got out of the hospital, Vietnam's still gone, but I could cover up a lot of wounds. And on the outside, I looked okay. I met my wife, convinced her I was normal. And we got married anyway, for the next 2 years, I put my wife through her own PTS program. She has a Purple Heart plate on her car. There's a reason for that, you know. And 2 years afterwards, she walked out. She said, I love you, but I can't, you know, you're killing me too. Well, right before that, we made the mistake of walking into a church. Now, my stepdad used to take us to a traditional church. You know, we grew up. And I don't think he ever should say anything bad about your background. Martin Luther would be concerned, but, you know, that's... Anyway, we went to this church that I had always felt comfortable in before, and we were ambushed. 2 born-again, spirit-filled Lutheran pastors that loved Jesus. And they had a group of people in there. They still had Lutherans, but they had a group of people in there that were spirit-filled, loved us, reached out to us. And they asked us to take part in a Bible study. And Shirley said, okay. And I looked at her like, you know, what are you thinking? But so we went to this Bible study, and they had that first night, they had icebreaker questions, you know, to make you feel comfortable when you already know you're not comfortable with that. Like the first time you walked into here and go, who are these people? So I'm trying to think of, you know, and the last question was, when was God real in your life? I'm trying to think of something that sounds religious. You know, cause I know peer pressure is just for younger people, but I did want to fit in. And so going around a room, church never happened before or since, but as I was sitting in that room with these 9 other couples, I was lifted up out of that room, and I was looking down in another room, and I saw a man laying on a bed, bloody and bleeding. And I heard him say, God, if you let me live, I'll do anything you want. And I was back in that room with a mirror in front of my face spiritually. I looked in that mirror. I saw a phony. I didn't like that person I saw. Now I realize God had spared my life. Why? But it took my wife walking out that brought me to rock bottom. We were separated 10 days. We were living in Omaha at the time. And, you know, we decided to get together. You know, we wanted our divorce to be amicable, you know, be friends, that kind of. And I like my version of it. We met in a public place. I live in the South, and, you know, he needed killing. Is a good it's justifiable, you know. I needed killing. But we met, and Shirley, you know, we knew these people had something different. And Shirley said, unless we put God first, we're not going to make it. And I said, I know that, but how do you do that? So we went to her apartment. I moved her out so quick so I could start having fun again. Did not have fun. And we went to her apartment and knelt by the bed and just cried out. I said, God, what's missing? And the still small voice of the Holy Spirit spoke and said, it's not what's missing, it's who's missing. You need Jesus. I didn't do this right. You know, I never watched Christian TV. You know, somebody would have said amen at our church. The pastor would have been scared half to death. And so I probably didn't do this right. But thank God that the word of God says, whoever calls upon the name of the Lord will be saved. I said, God, what's missing? I said, it's not what's missing, but who's missing? I said, Lord, if you can use somebody like me, here I am. And, you know, some of you veterans here, you know, every morning when I got up, well, some of you who have been hurt and wounded, every morning when I got up, I felt like I strapped 100 pounds of emotional combat gear on my back. I carried this weight of guilt, of shame, of hate, of bitterness, of unforgiveness. I carried this weight around every single day for 4.5 years. And that night, I said that simple prayer. The weight fell off of me. And if I thought that, if I doubted that anything had changed, when I went to bed that night and closed my eyes, I slept for the first time in 4.5 years. No nightmares of Vietnam since or before. I did have a bad dream one night that I was in a church, something like this, and I was preaching, and I was so boring, I fell asleep. But that was so God changed our life. He healed my body. He healed our marriage. Shirley and I have been married for 52 years, 8 months, and 22 days, not that I'm counting. I have 2 children that the doctor said I'd never have. I have 5 grandchildren and 1 great-granddaughter who's about 4 months old. Shortly after I became a Christian, you know, when I was medevaced out of Vietnam, when that plane lifted up, and they would have to accelerate as fast as they can because sometimes the enemy would be at the end of the runway and shoot at aircraft taking off. And, you know, you're at a medevac flight. You know, last thing you want to do is get shot again. And I was on a stretcher, probably about 3 or 4 off of the you know, high. But as the plane tilted to go over Da Nang Bay, Vietnam's a beautiful country. And I'm looking down the beautiful beaches, the fishing boats out there, the mountains, the green trees. But I looked out that window, and in my mind, I never wanted to ever see Vietnam again. Never. Because it was too painful. Shortly after I became a Christian and got saved in early December 74, 75, maybe February, March, I looked at Shirley and I said, I think I'm supposed to go back to Vietnam. Well, April 30th, 50 years ago, Vietnam fell and they were shut off from the outside world. Nobody was going to Vietnam. For 14 years, I'd go to missions conference, I'd talk to YWAM people, I'd talk to anybody that was going to Asia. What is going on in Vietnam? Nothing. And so 1988, Shirley and I had the honor of going to Focus on the Family, Dr. James Dobson, he was still in California. And Dr. Dobson was doing, we were gonna tape a series of three radio programs on PTS. They call it PTSD, I don't call it PTSD, I call it PTS. Because a disorder means there's something wrong with you. Having the wounds of whether it be Vietnam or abuse or rejection, that's not a disorder. That's your system reacting to what's not a normal situation. That's just my opinion, but when you get to heaven, you'll see I was right. And so we're on this program, and Dr. Dobson's interviewing several other veterans. And he said to one of them, he said, Bill, I understand you just got back from Vietnam. And I said, yeah. He said, I believe that God gave me a heart to take Christian Vietnam veterans back to with a message of reconciliation. You know, we all know 2 Corinthians 5:17. You know, if any person is in Christ or a new creation, the old passes away, all things become new. The next verse says, therefore, since we have been given this ministry of reconciliation, as I believe God wants veterans, Christian veterans, to take a message of reconciliation to our former enemy. And then, you know, I said to him, what do you get? You guys have any plans tonight? You know, after we tape, can we take you out to dinner? So we're talking about, and he's sharing his heart with me, and my heart's burning. And he says, he just looks at me. He says, you want to go? And I said, yeah, you know, pick Shirley up off the floor. And several months later, 14 or 23 years after my first trip to Vietnam, I'm on a plane, I'm in my 40s, and I'm going back with a camera bag and the gospel. And I could tell you so many stories about what God has done. I want to just tell one story in closing, and then we're going to minister. We took on a bunch of projects. We did some churches, but our favorite at the beginning was a polio orphanage. 450 children with polio. Handmade braces, you know, these kids, we would take toys and balloons and, you know, some clothing to these kids, and they were so happy. They had nothing. They were so happy. But, you know, and they just, you know, you want to see a bunch of hardened veterans just sob every time we left that orphanage after we had visited. You know, we just got tears running down our eyes. And so we had done a project. We repaired their therapy pool that hadn't worked since 75. And so we were negotiating. I was a team leader, so I was meeting with the communist officials that were over all the social services, you know, for Saigon. Saigon was a city of about 9 million at the time. And so we were veterans. We were Christians. We didn't hide that at all. And so all the communist officials were former soldiers, you know. And so we started, they always ask you, when were you here? Where did you serve? Whatever. And so as we're talking, the man over all the social services in 1966, we were on an operation on a DMZ, walked into a regimental base camp, and for 5 days we fought literally at times hand to hand to fight our way out of that jungle. Nearly half my company was wiped out. And as we were talking, the man that's in charge of social was the regimental commander of that unit. Asian culture has a thing called face saving. We had just made him look good, and now he realized I had some painful memories because of what his men did, you know, during the war. And so he looked through the interpreter. We had interpreters. Her name was Hin. She was a Buddhist girl. And he said, why do you come? Why do you do this for the people of Vietnam? He said, we had the Ford Foundation here. And you know, they said, oh yeah, we want to help the people of Vietnam. We showed them all the needs, and we've never seen them again. And then we had the Carnegie Foundation, same thing. We showed them all the, oh yeah, we wanted, and they never came back. You know, this may seem like a small thing to you, but it's not to us. Why do you do this? And so I looked at him and I said, sir, I said, Jesus Christ has healed all the painful memories that I experienced in Vietnam. And because of that, I can say that I love you and Jesus loves you. Now, there was about 12 communist officials on the other side of the table and three of us. Hin started weeping. My interpreter just started bawling. And they're looking at us, looking at her, looking at us like, what did you, you know, and we're like, awkward wasn't still a term yet, but it was awkward. And then after a couple minutes, she finally got her emotions under control and she asked me a question. And so she told the colonel what I said. He looked at her and looked at me. Look, he got up and he come around the long table. So I got up and he come up to me, looked up at me. I'm 6'4", most Vietnamese are not, you know, and he just threw his arms around me and had tears streaming down his eyes. And I'm kind of, you know. And afterwards, you know, I mean, we just hugged each other for the longest time. And it's, and he looked at him and said something. And she said, he asked me to tell you that he's never had an enemy tell him he loved him. Only Jesus. Only Jesus. The video, there's a video, 5.5 minute video of that story that's had 1.5 million hits on the internet. And it's not about me. I remember the first time they called and said, Raj, that video's had over 1 million views and hundreds of thousands of people gone the next step to know about Jesus. It's not about me, because we live in a world where there's a lot of people that are hurting. There's a lot of people, one, they need to know that they can be forgiven. And two, that they know no matter what they've experienced, what they've gone through, what they've been, what has happened to them, that God will give you the ability to forgive others no matter what they've done.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you'd like to help more people hear this message, you can get the word out by subscribing and sharing it on social media. If you'd like to support the ministries of Heartland Church, you can do so at heartlandchurchonline.com/give.